The reading is from Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 29, and that's on page 972. Matthew chapter 7, from verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, and not as their teachers of the law.
Thank you. It'd be a great help to me if you'd keep your Bibles open at that passage. Frosties, Weetabix, shredded wheat, Rice Krispies, all bran, bran flakes, muesli, ricicles. Decisions. One of the stresses facing the 90s man as he pushes his trolley around Sainsbury's is the problem of overchoice. Such a vast array of different options to go for. It's just as well that when it comes to cereals, it doesn't really matter what ends up in your breakfast bowl in the morning. And against the backdrop of a day such as this one, the decisions of this sort of nature stand out for the trivia that they really are. Not so, however, of the decision before us this evening. It couldn't be more different. It is both straightforward, there are only two options, and it is vitally important. Namely, the decision about how to respond to what Jesus has said. The passage that was just read in Matthew 7 marks the end of the so-called Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is doing his summing up. Therefore, he begins in verse 24. And the force of this is, so then, where does this all leave us? It's that sort of idea. And what Jesus does is he puts before us very starkly the two options that we have. And I want us to look together at these options with a view to either confirming you in the decision you've made, or challenging you to choose again, depending on which option you've gone for. And we're going to do this by asking two questions. The first question is, what are the options? And the second question is, why is this the biggest decision in our lives? So firstly then, what are the options? It's good to be clear about exactly what the alternatives are. And the passage falls very neatly into two halves. Option one is verses 24 to 25. Option one is to put Jesus' words into practice, as it says in verse 24. Option two is verses 26 and 27. It is, as verse 26 says, not to put Jesus' words into practice. So it's simple enough, those are the alternatives. Those who've heard the words of Jesus can only go one of two ways. Act on them, or fail to act on them. Well, which of those two would you say best represents you at the moment? In order to be able to answer that question, you have to be clear about what Jesus' words actually are. So when he talks about these words of mine, in verse 24, what is he referring to? Well, he's clearly referring back to what he's been saying in the Sermon on the Mount. This is what his hearers will either practice or fail to practice. But what does it mean to practice or to fail to practice the Sermon on the Mount? What is the Sermon on the Mount on about? Well, rather than merely repeat what has been said over the past Sunday evening series, by way of a brief review, I thought we'd sum up things in medical terms for a change. So cast in ER language, this is basically what is going on in the Sermon on the Mount. The Bible story so far is that the human race is wasting away under the ravages of not just an epidemic, which is a widespread disease, but a pandemic. That is a disease affecting the whole world. This disease is called sin. Because of it, we're spiritually wasting away. And we're cut off from relationship with God because this disease isn't allowed in His kingdom. God, in His mercy, promises to send us a physician, a specialist who alone can deal with the disease. He promises that He'll descend from Abraham. And Matthew chapter 1 records the birth of Jesus and shows that He descends from Abraham. So far, so good. Chapter 1, verse 21, we read, He's to be called Jesus because He will save His people from their sins. There's His job description. He's the great physician born into our world to deal with this problem of sin, the disease. Either side of the Sermon on the Mount, we see Jesus in action. He's going around healing physical diseases. For example, in chapter 4, verse 23 onwards. These are demonstrations physically of what He can do and will do spiritually. So what is going on in the Sermon on the Mount itself? Well, basically, the sermon presents us with what spiritual health looks like. It is a picture of spiritual health. So it draws a picture of the spiritually healthy person, giving examples of how they relate to God and to other people. For what purpose? Well, there are two reasons. Firstly, it pushes us to ask for the remedy. When we see what spiritual health looks like, we should realize that we are sick. We don't measure up. So, for example, in chapter 7, verse 12, Jesus says this. In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. That is spiritual health. Well, do you do it? In everything? No. Well, nor do I. We're sick. We've got the disease. We need to ask the doctor for the remedy. That is to say, for forgiveness, for mercy. So that is how it works. So that people will rely on Him for the remedy, the physician first needs to show them that they're sick. Jesus observes in chapter 9, verse 12, it isn't the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. So we need to realize that we are sick first of all. So the Sermon on the Mount pushes us to ask for the remedy and to keep on taking that medicine. That is point one of what Jesus is saying. There is, however, a second and a secondary point to the sermon, which is this. For those who put themselves in the hands of this great physician and are on his medicine, the sermon provides a regime for living. A regime for living. Now, you'll be familiar with what a regime is. It is a prescribed way of life or a diet. This is a regime for a healthy spiritual lifestyle. Now, seeking to follow it cannot deal with the disease. Only the medicine can do that. But if you are in the hands of the great physician and you are taking his medicine, he expects you to be committed to healthy living, spiritually. To not to do so would be to make a mockery of everything he stands for as the great physician. Imperfect, yes. Failing to measure up again and again, sadly, yes. But basically committed to it. And seeking to live it out. So to have Jesus as your doctor means accepting him, his authority over you as your physician. You put your life in his hands. And we're saying that means you keep taking his medicine, the forgiveness made possible by the cross, and you are committed to the healthy living guide. In other terms, the Sermon on the Mount pushes us to ask for the remedy. And it provides us with a regime for healthy living. So there's a brief review in medical terms of what Jesus has been saying. Well, now the options before us should be a bit clearer. Option one is to do what Jesus says. Now, given what we've just seen, that means to accept him as your doctor, spiritually, submitting to his authority. That is what it means to put Jesus' words into practice. Option two is to not do what Jesus says. That is to reject Jesus' authority over you as your physician. That is what it means to not put his words into practice. So those are the options before us. Again, which best represents you at the moment? Option two isn't just the preserve of the egg-throwing, scoffing heckler. It is quite possible to reject Jesus' authority over you as your physician in more subtle ways. So, for example, some people hear his words and take copious notes and then file them away neatly, but they don't do what Jesus says. Some people love to listen to preachers explaining Jesus' words, but again, they don't do what Jesus says. King Herod in Mark chapter 4 was such a man. We read that he liked to listen to the preacher John the Baptist and what he had to say about Jesus, but he never put it into practice. Very chilling words, those. He liked to listen. The 18th century scientist and politician Benjamin Franklin was such a man. He was mesmerized by George Whitefield's preaching about Jesus, but he never did what Jesus said. And some people spend a whole lifetime of Sundays sitting in church pews, listening to sermons, but never actually do what the great physician says. Other people listen to Jesus' words as amateur critics. As preachers expound them, they award scores, but they don't put them into practice. They're like the people of Israel in Ezekiel chapter 33, of whom God says to the prophet, "My people come to you as they usually do, and they sit before you to listen to your words, but they do not put them into practice. Indeed, to them you are nothing more than one who sings love songs with a beautiful voice and plays an instrument well. For they hear your words, but they do not put them into practice." Indeed, as last week's passage made clear, many who say, "Lord, Lord," to Jesus, still do not actually put Jesus' words into practice. So these then are the option two people. They don't accept Jesus as their physician. Two options having heard Jesus' words. Two possible responses. Well, which would you say best represents you at the moment? Well, having seen firstly what the two options are, the big question is, why is this the biggest decision in our lives? What is so great about one option over the other? Well, this is the crunch, isn't it? And what goes on here in this account is Jesus likens these two options to the choice of where to build your house. That is the picture he uses. And in verse 24, he explains that if you do what he says, you're like a wise man who builds his house on the rock. Jesus' verdict on you, if you go for option one, if you do what he says, his verdict on you is that you are wise. You have chosen well. You'll see that in verse 24. Now, this has nothing whatsoever to do with your IQ or your education or your learning. You could have the brains of a rocking horse. But if you do what Jesus says, his verdict on you is that you are wise, whoever you are. In verse 24, he says this applies to everyone who does what he says. On the other hand, in verse 26, he explains that if you go for option two, and you don't do what he says, you are like a fool, a foolish man in verse 26, who builds his house on the sand. Jesus' verdict on you is that you are a fool. Now again, this is not questioning your education or your IQ. You could be a card-carrying member of Mensa. You could have won a gold medal at the recent Mind Sports Olympiad, that prestigious international event at which our country seems to excel. You could have starred A's in all your GCSEs. Notwithstanding, if you don't put Jesus' words into practice, his estimation of you is fool. And the Greek word for fool in verse 26 is moros, from which we derive the English word moron. What is so great about one option over the other? Well, Jesus' verdict is that to choose option one is wise, to choose option two is foolish. Well, I mean, that's fine. It's nice to be thought of as wise, isn't it? But, I mean, is that it? Is that all there is to it? Is that all there is to choose between these two options? it hardly seems to be the biggest decision in life. Picture in your mind's eye a valley, and on the left side of this valley is a nice red house built by Will the wise man. This house is built on rock, and Jesus says he's wise. And then on the right side of the valley is a nice blue house, and that is built by Phil the fool. And his house is built on sand. Now the two men settle down in their respective homes. After a while, though, things become rather unsettled. You see, Phil the fool is quite outspoken, and he was heard saying recently the following. So, Jesus thinks I'm a fool for building here. Big deal. I'm not bothered. I'm happy. I don't need his approval. My life's okay. Doesn't fuss me that the house is built on sand. I mean, it's solid enough. Does me just fine. As for you, Will the wise, as far as I'm concerned, you're the fool, not me, and my friends agree with me. Look at you. So concerned to build your nice house on the rock over there. Yeah, well, big difference it's made. What's so wise about building there then? Well, Will the wise is somewhat shaken by this, and he starts to think, well, maybe there's something in what Phil's saying. I've built on the rock, and Jesus says I'm wise for doing that, but maybe Phil's right. What good is it doing me? All it's got me is hassle from Phil and his friends, and I still have the same troubles as everyone else. I still have illness and failures and deaths in the family. And meanwhile, Phil over there seems to be doing just fine. He has parties, successes, an extension to his house. Have you ever felt this tension? They're real issues, aren't they? The wise person who does what Jesus says often does seem to have a rough time of it. Whereas the fool often does seem to be doing just well. Thank you very much. Seems to be doing fine. What good is it then putting Jesus' words into practice? What difference does it make? Is it worth the hassle? What is the big deal about building on the rock anyway? I mean, Jesus says it's wise, but what's the good of it? What is so great about option one? One day, Will and Phil looked out of their windows, and they noticed the sky darkening and the wind picking up. Thunder rumbled in the distance. Rain began to pitter-patter on the roof and the windows, and an hour later the trickles on the ground outside had become streams. By nightfall, the wind was blowing force 8 to 9, and rain was lashing the house, and the water was rising. Will the wise was huddled in his house as the eye of the storm moved down the valley towards him. When he woke up in the morning, he lay in bed and he listened. Silence. All was quiet. He opened the front door and the sunshine flooded in, and outside everything was glistening wet. And he turned to go over to Phil's house to see how he had got on. And as he turned, he stopped in his tracks. He blinked. Nothing there. No house, no Phil, nothing. All gone, swept away. And all that remained was the little sign saying Phil's house, lying in a puddle on the sand. The big deal about what you build on will only be seen when the storm comes. Of the wise person's house, verse 25 says, the rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. Of the fool's house, verse 27 says, the rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When the storm comes, it will matter what your foundation is on. It will matter what you have done with Jesus' words. Now, the storm is a picture with a biblical background. We're not at liberty to just read into the storm whatever we like. So, the storms of exams, or the storms of difficult times. In the Bible, the storm is a picture, and it is a picture of God's judgment. For example, in Ezekiel 13, the Lord says this, "In my wrath, I will unleash a violent wind, And in my anger, hailstones and torrents of rain will fall with destructive fury. So I will spend my wrath. Isaiah 28 uses similar imagery. The Lord warns, hail will sweep away your refuge, and water will overflow your hiding place. And it's all in the context of God's work of judgment in verse 21 of that chapter. And the context of this concluding section in Matthew 7 from verse 13 onwards makes clear that the final judgment is in view here. So verse 13 speaks about destruction. In verse 19, of fire. In verse 22, on that day, the day of judgment. The storm is a picture of God's final judgment. Palestine is well known for its torrential rains that can turn dry wadis into raging torrents in a few minutes. And as a picture of God's judgment, the storm is a terrifying and a very powerful image. This isn't a wind whistling in the trees English storm. This is more like a Florida hurricane. Why is this the biggest decision in life? It is because in the end, the difference could not be greater. Look at the contrast. Firstly, the wise builder. Will and his house survive, in verse 25. It didn't fall. The wise person who does what Jesus says will survive the judgment and come through unscathed. They will be kept safe because they're built on the rock. That is Jesus' promise. So if you are a wise builder this evening, this is the benefit of having built on the rock. It just shows, doesn't it, how vital the future perspective is. If you lose sight of the coming storm, you might well wonder whether building on the rock was worth the hassle. You might well look at Phil the Fool and wonder whether you've really made the wise choice. I mean, it's hard. In a world with topsy-turvy values, the building on the rock is seen as the foolish option. Remember what it says in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18? The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, to the world. If you forget about the storm, in order to keep going, the temptation is to start pretending. Pretending that life now is better than it actually is, in order to justify your choice. You can end up in a virtual reality world in which you claim that in your house, everyone is happy and everyone is healthy and successful now in this life. What's the good of building on the rock, Will? Oh, well, my life is so much better now in every way. I mean, I'm carefree. Everything is going well. I'm successful. And this cheesy grin is real, honest. You see, this is where you can end up if you lose sight of the storm. Because you have to somehow justify building on the rock. So you overplay the benefits in this life. And I'm sure that you, as well as I, will have sat through evangelistic talks which take this sort of line. And I don't know about you, but I just end up feeling embarrassed. Because I think, well, this is unreal. It is significant that here, Jesus gives one reason why it is wise to build on the rock. You will be kept safe when the storm of judgment comes. If you have chosen to do so, you are wise. And on that day, you will come through unscathed. That is why it is the wise option. And that is why it is worth sticking with it. As for the foolish builder, Phil and his house don't survive. They're swept away, in verse 27. It fell with a great crash. In the Greek, the last word of the sermon is the word great. The fall was great. The Greek word is mega. It was a mega crash. And it is a solemn end to the sermon. Are you someone who's been thinking that it's not worth doing what Jesus says? Hey, what's the point? Life is fine as it is. Jesus is saying, look to the future. That is why you need to build on the rock. If you don't, you'll be swept away when the storm of judgment comes. You won't survive. And I don't know, but maybe people have tried to persuade you before with tales of how wonderful life on the rock actually is. Well, the full story is that it's quite hard. You still have the hassles of life, like everyone else. In addition, you have the opposition of the world with its topsy-turvy values. And back in chapter 5, Jesus says to people on the rock, "Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven." Not now, in heaven. The truth is that on the rock you're not guaranteed a happy, carefree life. You're not guaranteed employment. You're not guaranteed physical health. What you are guaranteed is that you will come through the storm of judgment unscathed. And that is when the perfect life will begin, in God's new world, on the far side of the storm. And that is why you are a fool to build on the sand. That is why you need to build on the rock by putting Jesus' words into practice. So if at the moment you're a Phil the fool in Jesus' story, why not become wise? I mean, you can't alter your IQ very much, and it takes a long time to increase in learning, but you could become truly wise in an instant. It's just a question of choosing to rebuild, of choosing option one, and starting to do what Jesus says, putting your life in his hands as your physician. Now, the claims of this man are absolutely astonishing. I mean, they were then in the first century. Notice the reaction in verses 28 and 29. The crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority. And these claims are no less astonishing today. And a man who did the sort of miracles Jesus did, and a man who was raised from the dead, has to be taken seriously. Why not become wise and do what Jesus says, if you haven't already done that? Whatever else you're building your life on, Jesus says, is sand, and it will be useless on the day of God's judgment. Jesus is giving you planning permission to rebuild on the rock. I couldn't contemplate rebuilding now, and I've lived too long on the sand. I'm too old to change now and start rebuilding, and my life's okay. Listen to the forecast. The storm is coming. Don't be short-sighted. Don't be a fill. Give yourself a future on the far side of the storm. Well, all of us have heard Jesus' words, but hearing doesn't change anything. What matters, Jesus says, is what we do with his words. And in the light of the coming storm, that has got to be the biggest decision in anyone's life. Well, we're going to have a few minutes of quiet for personal reflection before William introduces the final song.